Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll begin today with a conversation with Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch. A little over a month ago, Congress declassified a long-awaited section of the 2002 investigation into the 9/11 attacks. For more than a decade, Congress had refused to make public the so-called 28 pages, a special section of the report that examined the Saudi government's possible role in the attacks. Representative Lynch led the effort to declassify those 28 pages. Now, the redacted documents do not reach any conclusion about Saudi involvement in the 9/11 attacks, but they do provide other details, such as FBI information that Abu Zubaydah, a senior al-Qaeda operative, possessed the phone number of a corporation that managed, quote, the affairs of the Colorado residence of Saudi Prince Bandar. The 28 pages also stress that much of the information has not been verified. Well, we are, of course, approaching the 15th anniversary of the attacks of September 11th. And when we spoke with Congressman Lynch earlier today, I began by asking him about a 2014 statement he made to the New Yorker magazine. Back then, he said he believed the 28 pages contained, quote, stunning clarity about the Saudi government and 9/11. Lynch pointed to the section of the document devoted to a Saudi national named Omar al-Bayoumi, a suspected Saudi intelligence agent who had contact with two of the hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midhar.
These two individuals were supported by Saudi citizens who had very strong connections to the Saudi government, the Saudi royal family. They were supported financially. They were assisted in getting housing. I think Bayoumi actually helped them get to survey flight schools so that they could get lessons on flying commercial airliners. So two individuals didn't know the language at all, were basically handled during this whole time. And by these agents were the whole process of the 9/11 attacks were facilitated.
Yeah, so Bayoumi was believed to have been a Saudi spy, right, or at least connected with the Saudi
intelligence agent.
Intelligence agent. I was reading that in fact he was actually stripped of his diplomatic privileges in 2002.
Right, he tried to come back into the country.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, the 9/11 Commission later on said that the more damning allegations, they couldn't find any substantial evidence to support them.
Well, the 9/11 investigation only had a brief amount of time. If you read the 28 pages, just read the first five sentences, basically says that there were connections between the Saudi government and the hijackers, and that they are unable in the limited time they had to definitively say, you know, what those connections were. I think what is really damning about this is that in spite of the fact that there were 19 hijackers and, you know, all these connections between the Saudi government and the hijackers, the FBI never engaged in an investigation of the Saudi connection. It was only when the Congress came together and appointed the special inquiry, that was a year later. And what did they say? What did the FBI say when the 9/11 Commission contacted them for evidence? They said, we knew you would do that. We knew you would do that. So they basically let the trail end right there. A major attack killing thousands of Americans, and the FBI puts their feet up and waits for Congress a year later to then begin. I mean, that just kills me. It kills me. That's not incompetence. That's willful ignorance right there.
You know, I was reading an article written by Richard Clark just very recently. Of course, mm-hmm. Richard Clark was the national coordinator for counterterrorism, both under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. I mean, he was the one who wrote the infamous Bin Laden memo, right?
Right.
And he says he wonders if part of the reason why the FBI had never been informed prior to 9/11 of the presence of these two men in Southern California. Because he says that the CIA knew they were here in the United States, and that the CIA had actually been asking the Emirates, Malaysia, and Thai intelligence services to keep track of these guys before they first came to the United States. And yet they never told the FBI that these two al-Qaeda operatives were in the U.S. And he's wondering why that is and how we might ever find the answer to that question.
Right. Now, obviously, there was a serious lack of information sharing. And that goes on to this day that, you know, it's gotten a lot better since 9/11, but I think the events of 9/11 certainly throw a lot of that lack of communication into contrast.
Yeah.
You know, it's just it's deplorable, but it happened, and I don't know how we undo the lack of communication back then. All we can do is try to do better going forward.
Now, there are aspects of the report which are also still not public. For example, interviews with President George W. Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and even I guess the 9/11 commission interviewed President Bill Clinton as well. Would you like to see those portions be made public?
Absolutely. And there are other documents that were requested. ATM transfers of cash from Saudi Arabia to the United States, trying to get those documents from the Saudi government. We've been unsuccessful up to this point and have been for a number of years. So, you know, I'd like all of that information to be made public. And hopefully there are some enterprising journalists that are out there that are digging for this information.
What would you like to see happen if more of these aspects of the reports get made public? I mean, what do you want the consequences to be?
Well, I think the root of this is really the extremist madrasas all over the world. You know, I was in Mumbai recently, and out there on the dump, one of the biggest dumps. It's like a mountain. You know, there's an extremist madrasa, you know, bringing in poor, you know, Indian kids, pumping out that vitriolic and extreme Wahhabi doctrine into those young people. That's happening all over the globe, and Saudi Arabia is the source of that. I just think that the more the story is told of what went on then and what continues to go on today, I think will open a lot of people's eyes, I think, and maybe force the Saudi government to recognize what they're doing.
So, Congressman Lynch, I think this is an extraordinarily important point, actually, because the United States has long officially sanctioned Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism.
Right.
There's material evidence that has happened.
Right.
I can see how, if some of the allegations in those 28 pages are substantiated, then there would be material evidence of Saudi support of the 9/11 hijackers. But do we really even need that material evidence for the United States to tell Saudi Arabia, we're going to put sanctions on you, we're going to change our diplomatic relationship, we're going to do something because you are supporting, you know, ideological forces around the world that are in opposition or not in the national security of the United States?
Yeah, I agree with you. There's enough information out there now to allow us to move in that direction.
Why does it matter to you so much that these 15 years later, I mean, it's been 15 years, right?
Right.
Why are you still pushing to get this information out there?
I don't know. Maybe it's just I was elected on September 11th. That was the day of my Democratic primary here in Massachusetts. So I went to Washington immediately after that, and obviously we had a lot of victims of 9/11 that were from our area. Mm-hmm. You meet with those families, and they're still looking for answers. Some of them are part of a lawsuit against the Saudi government and would like to have justice done.
Yeah, can you tell me what one of the toughest moments you had in the process to get these 28 pages released, and what happened?
A lot of it was frustrating rather than just painful. But I remember back in, I think, 2012, they made you make an appointment to read the 28 pages, and you had to go down the basement of the Capitol where the old SCIF was. You had to sit across from intelligence staffers or agency people, and they would watch you as you read the 28 pages. You weren't allowed a pen. You weren't allowed any electronics, and you weren't allowed to speak about it. But I remember after reading the 28 pages, and clearly there were indications that there was greater complicity than was being publicly acknowledged. At the end of it, I said, you know, I just want you to be clear. I'm going to try to make these pages public. I think the American public deserves to have this information, and I think the families, the surviving families, deserve to have that information. So that sort of was a challenge to them, and then everything that happened afterwards, they were saying that, you know, these notes were just so sensitive that it would disclose methods and sources and things like that. Then when we got them declassified, they switched in the same breath, and they said, well, there weren't methods and sources that need to be protected. There's just nothing there. There's nothing there. That this is all stuff that was out there before. These were all preliminary assessments, and there's nothing really there.
But so, you'd seen them.
Yeah, right.
So what was your reaction?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just we have to continue to really make sure that the government is doing what we want them to do. And there are so many areas of secrecy, and some of our systems are so opaque that they invite corruption and invite, misguided adventures. The bigger and more complex government becomes, it becomes more difficult to really keep a rein on some of our government agencies like the FBI, like the CIA. There are a lot of great people there, but, in a very real sense, there's also a huge need for us to make sure that they operate, at least in a theater of transparency, with members of Congress and members of the Intelligence Committee, so we know exactly what the heck they're doing.
You're making an observation that many people share, and it makes me wonder what you think. You know, is there a lesson to be drawn with how investigators and intelligence agencies and the government as a whole handled, you know, the classification and then declassification of these 28 pages that we ought to be actively applying to, you know, our current fight against terrorism?
While there is certainly an area where government has to operate in a classified environment, I don't doubt that. But they've got to be honest with someone. And really, they kept a lot of Congress in the dark about this, about what was going on, about their operations. They've become so compartmentalized in the CIA and I think in the FBI that at times they see Congress as the enemy as opposed to Congress representing the people. And I think that's an unhealthy trend in government today.
You know, this zeal for secrecy isn't any particular to any one party, because I think if I'm remembering correctly, the Obama administration has made more documents than classified than just about anyone.
I understand that, yeah.
Congressman Lynch, before we let you go, this has been absolutely fascinating, and thank you so much for talking to us about this, especially as, you know, we are coming towards the 15th anniversary of 9/11. But can we talk about a couple other Massachusetts issues while I've got
Let's
you here?
That.
Mostly because there are several really interesting ballot questions on the ballot this November here. And I'm wondering, first of all, I just want to ask you quickly about charter schools, because there seems to be quite a significant divide amongst Massachusetts Democrats about whether or not they want to lift the cap on charter schools and how they might vote on question two. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm actually co-founder of a charter school, so I believe in them. A lot of people were moving out of my district once their kids became school age because they could not find a decent school that they had confidence in. I joined with Brett Pizer and Susan Fortin to create the Boston Collegiate Charter School. It's I'm proud to say it's one of the top charter schools, top public schools, period, in the state.
You did this back in 97, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm very much pro-charter school, no question about it. I don't necessarily think they're the be-all and end-all, but I certainly am very, very supportive of them, and I support expanding the cap. For a long time, we had dysfunctional traditional public schools that could just continue to operate that way and would have a new class of students come every year, regardless of whether they were functioning or not. And so it just it condemned a lot of young people to substandard education, unfortunately.
Okay, so let me ask you a different side of the story then, because you have long been a very passionate supporter of labor and unions.
Union president.
Yeah, absolutely. You were telling us just before we started that you've paid up your dues through November.
Yeah.
But I was just reading that just last week, the National Labor Relations Board, for the purposes of labor negotiations, have determined that they will look at charter schools as private corporations because of the fact that, you know, many charter schools do not employ unionized teachers. Does that give you any pause for concern?
I haven't read the decision. So, and as a labor lawyer, I wouldn't want to just talk off the cuff that. So I probably have an uninformed opinion on that, and that's not good. So I'd rather read the NLRB decision and try to decipher what their input was.
Okay, so we'll talk to you about it after you get a chance to
read
it.
I'm happy to speak.
It's sort of an interesting wrinkle in this very complicated story about surrounding question two. Let's move to the question that could legalize marijuana in Massachusetts. Your take on that?
Yeah, I also founded a facility for adolescent drug rehab. It's the Cushing House. So I'm very much involved in the recovery community. I had problems with alcohol myself in my early years. And I've not met a young person yet that didn't start with marijuana. Now we're going to put these drugs on the street legally and push them out there. I just don't think that flooding the streets with drugs, another drug, is good for society, is good for our country, is good for our young people. How could pumping more and more and more drugs out into the street, how is that a good thing? How is that a good thing?
Well, another frequent and impassioned argument from people who want legalization, as they say, we're imprisoning too many people for marijuana possession. If you legalize it, then we wouldn't be doing that if it were legal.
I don't know how many people now are being imprisoned. It had to be for bulk, you know, transfers, because people smoking dope are not getting arrested. If you talk to Commissioner Evans or any major city in Massachusetts, we're not arresting people.
I mean, possession has been decriminalized in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
That's true.
So I think it's a move in the wrong direction. I know I'm in the minority on that. I just have to go with what I know. And, I just think that it's having more and more drugs on the street is not a good thing.
Well, finally, Congressman, we've rounded the corner around Labor Day, and now in terms of the presidential election, it's a mad dash to the finish.
It is.
There's a new CNN poll out that shows Donald Trump actually leading Hillary Clinton by 1 point.
Dear God.
Among likely voters.
Yeah.
I remember that when President Obama was on Martha's Vineyard this summer at a Democratic fundraiser, he warned against Democrats getting complacent.
Yeah.
And do you worry that might happen? Because it seems as the race is tightening.
Yeah, I worry. I think there's, especially for us in Massachusetts, there's a real sense of complacency. I've talked with Mayor Walsh. I think we're going to try to go to Wisconsin and Iowa to talk to some of the labor folks out there to impress upon them the difference between what a Donald Trump administration would be for working families versus what Hillary Clinton would do.
Do you think that Hillary Clinton could be doing a better job of speaking to working families and talking maybe more passionately and directly about exactly what her administration would do in support of them?
Yeah, I suppose you can always do better. It's been tough to break through with the campaign that Donald Trump is running. Is really one of vitriol and push-button issues, you know, the immigration issue, build a wall, things like that. So that's where the energy has gone. I don't think they've – maybe with the debates, we will be able to drill down and actually have an adult conversation about the direction of each candidate and what they would do. I think that would in that context, in that environment where you can actually have a decent exchange of ideas, I think Hillary's superior experience and intellect will come through.
Well, Congressman Stephen Lynch, thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Meghna. Good to be with you.
And Congressman Lynch is the ranking Democrat on the House Subcommittee on National Security. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.